you have to believe it for yourself, right? Like you have to believe that you've built up value in what you've been doing. The reality is a lot of startups fail. A lot of successful startup founders have failed multiple times before they found their winning. And so I think you have to really be careful not to discount yourself. Just being honest, like here are the areas I still have limitations in, but here are the skills that I have built. I think it can help you build your own confidence in yourself.
Hi, I am Sophie Vu, and this is the Rise and Play podcast. In the show, I sit down with influential thought leaders in the gaming industry to deconstruct how they create the best teams and company cultures in order to create the best games. Speaking to hundreds of game executives in the show, I have identified recurring patterns and mistakes that we all make in our leadership journey. Do you have to go through the same hurdles and make the same mistakes to learn too? You are not alone in this journey, and hopefully you can learn from a diverse range of seasoned leaders who already walked the talk. Every episode brings actionable insights and case studies that will help you improve your management skills, self-awareness, and empathic communication. Becoming a better leader starts with becoming a better human. Are you ready to unlock your full potential in life and business? Let's begin. So hello everyone, welcome to a new episode of Rise and Play. And in this cold winter time, I have someone calling from Toronto. I feel very wintry, like my times in Finland anyway. I'm very pleased to have Veronica Rojas today on the podcast. And before we begin the conversation, I was looking for some time to have other female founders, female CEOs. I've reached out to most of them. And, you know, at some point when I asked for help, other women, men, whoever can help, I had more names coming up. So I'm so happy to just connect with you today. And before we start, a quick intro about Veronica. Veronica is the co-CEO at Oaken Games, where she leads a dynamic team primarily based in Toronto with additional members scattered globally. And with a background in product management and product marketing, the interesting part for me as well as a career path, she climbed the ranks at Oaken, progressing from senior product manager to co-CEO in just 5 years, which is amazing. And I'm sure we'll talk about how did that happen as maybe an aspiration for other listeners. And prior to Oaken, Veronica contributed to Disney Magic Kingdoms, a very also successful game by Gameloft. You were part of a studio in Toronto, where I know so other peers such as Julie Beaugrand, who's now head of studio at Rovio. And you also worked on various other mobile titles at Behavior in Montreal. Worth mentioning, Veronica also previously co-founded a startup, a game studio focusing on educational games for children. But I'll stop here for now because I'm sure we talk about a topic you're very passionate about around innovation, leadership, creating meaningful gaming experience, diverse audiences. I've heard that before, you know, from similar leaders. How do you feel today? How do you feel about doing this first podcast together?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion. And thank you for the lovely introduction as well. Yeah, I'm feeling good. I'm excited. It's my first podcast experience. So I'm very excited to get into things and have this chat today.
And let's begin a bit more like looking what I find interesting about your path. And maybe this is where something I've been reflecting on. How do women in games grow to a position of power? I've seen emerging patterns by asking this question regularly. And today I wanted also to understand your path that may be part of those patterns or your singular story. So how did you get into games? Where do you start from?
You know, my formal education is in games. So I knew from pretty early on in my career, I would say in high school, you know, you're asked to pick a career and, you know, you're a teenager. I'm not sure how anyone really expects that to go well. But yeah, I was identifying very early on that, you know, I'm interested in art and I like creative things and games are quite interesting to me. And so, you know, it was important for my family, for my mom that I go to a university. And at the time, games programs were just starting to come around. And that year that I was looking, there was only one university program, at least within Canada and Ontario, that I was interested in. And it was specifically focused on game development. Definitely from early on in my career, I'd been focused on games. I've taken a little bit of some, you know, experiences in other places throughout my career, but certainly my core career has been on games and specifically on mobile games as well.
Mm. So what did you study in this program? Because, I mean, especially mobile games, I would say it's, what, 10, 15 years old. And what skills or materials have you learned that give you the opportunities to start in games?
Yeah, so the university program was very comprehensive. It was specifically a game development and entrepreneurship program. So quite diverse in terms of the courses that were offered. I learned everything from, you know, programming, doing the engineering components, doing the visuals, creative writing, the design, everything involved in creating a game. And part of the activities during that experience was to actually create games. So forming small teams with peer groups and developing real games from scratch. And so that experience, I think, was very foundational to my understanding of all the things that go into making games. You know, it's not one person, it's an entire team of people. And everyone has to be very, you know, focused on what they're doing and very talented and skilled in the areas of their expertise. And so in most programs, you would just see, you know, development and engineering, or you would just see art, or you would just see one part of it. Mm. But I was really able to get that full breadth of understanding of everything that goes into making games.
I'm curious, what was the engine you were using at the time for during the program?
Yeah, so we were using an engine that was created by one of the professors. So that was quite exciting and very a unique experience. I think it had a lot of, you know, challenges from the development side as well. But yeah, it's very custom.
And as you get out of a university program with a, I don't even know how to call it, was that a game, I don't know, leadership certificate, diploma? How do you go about like looking for a job in the industry? What were the options available for you once out of the university?
Yeah, so I graduated with a Bachelor of Information Technology and honors in game development and entrepreneurship. So it is a very unique sort of niche. And when myself and my peers were graduating, we were looking around at what was available in the industry, what jobs out there, you know, could we apply to. And we were finding a lot of challenge with postings that said, you know, entry level positions, but you're also expected to have a few years of experience. And so as new grads, it was really daunting. This idea of trying to find a role and, you know, breaking into the games industry is notoriously hard. And so, yeah, for us, we sort of looked at each other and said, well, maybe we should, you know, form a startup and try and make our own games and give that a go. You know, if we're not able to, you know, easily get a position in the industry, like, let's make our own position and let's make our own company and, you know, see how far we can get with it.
Mm, I love that. And I think this is a reminder, even in this specific time of, I would say, job crisis, I see more people, at least it looks like it, losing jobs than one getting new jobs. And when opportunities are not available for you here, it's a typical situation where let's create our own opportunities and create our own company. So could you walk us through a bit the steps of how you created the company? How many were you? What was your role there? What was your focus? And where did that journey take you?
So it was myself and four peers from university. It was the same group that worked together on some of the projects that I mentioned for the university program. So we'd already had some experience of working together. We had pretty clear roles within those projects. And so it translated pretty naturally to an actual business and company. And so when we started, of course, we didn't have any income. And so that was challenging. You know, we're new graduates. I do think it's the best time to do that. You don't have, you know, a mortgage to worry about. You don't have kids. It's really the best time, best opportunity. And so, yeah, we sort of dove in. It was really challenging at the beginning. I was working a part-time sort of retail job just to kind of keep some income coming in.
Whoa.
We had the team working on outsourced projects. So we were doing some work for hire just to get some money coming in the door to kind of keep our rent paid. It was a very unique situation because we decided to rent a house, live together, have our studio in that house. It was very scrappy. And, you know, I think we were all very committed to that mission of like, let's try and actually build this business. Let's try and make these games. And so it was certainly, I think the first year was just figuring out how to survive. And then we kind of transitioned to, okay, now we need to really get real about the games that we're making and our mission here. And so I think part of that change happened when we were engaging with a, who was a local incubator that was running a competition for yeah, businesses that were just getting started or new extensions of businesses. And so for us, it was a really interesting experience to go out and learn how to pitch our business, how to explain what we're doing, how to figure out what we're even doing so that we can explain it. So I believe it was 2 months or something like that, the length of this pitching competition. And we actually won that competition. So I think it was a really great boost of morale for the team. You know, we felt like we were really on to something. And we felt that we also had that support that we so desperately needed to sort of take it to the next level. And so with that, we were able to really enhance how we were going about our business, how we were selling our products, how we were thinking about that. And we actually had some capital so that we could focus less on the work for hire and more on the actual projects that we wanted to develop.
Mm-hmm. I have so many questions, especially first company, you don't have a prior experience, which is good. Sometimes you just get into it and see what happens. And you were so many, you said five, right? Yourself and four people. So how did you organize yourself at that time? Where I'm coming from with the question, you know, like now there's a bit more maturity, a structure, how companies are formed, and there's a scrutiny in choosing who are your co-founders. Like that's the conversation I'm part of, whether on the investment side or with founders directly. What is the impact of the games we're making? How are you leveraging all strengths and so on? Did you have any of that? And how did you organize yourself? Like you, Veronica, how was the role you played? And what type of games were you making as well?
Yeah, so the role that I played in the company was sort of a jack of all trades. So my title is CEO, but a CEO of a startup doesn't mean a whole lot. Basically meant that I was doing, you know, everything that needed to get done that wasn't the actual development. So I was supporting the team as best I could. I was working with content experts. So the game that we were building was a fire safety game for kids. The purpose for the game was when kids reach a certain age, they're able to stay at home, you know, alone after school for a few hours before their parents get home. And so it's a really sort of transitionary time for the kids, but it's also one where dangers can be sort of present. And being aware of fire safety and being aware of what to do if there is an issue at the home and, you know, the child is at home on their own, you know, how are they going to deal with that situation is really important information. And, you know, the way that it's taught currently is through brochures and talks at schools. And so we thought, you know, we can really innovate on this area of opportunity. It's something that, you know, could help and be a benefit to society. You know, we're helping kids and we're educating. And I think there was a lot of value in that mission. And so, yeah, I was spending a lot of time working with content experts, trying to understand, you know, how does a fire progress? What are the signals that you need to be careful and conscious of? And what can you do? What should you not do? You know, when you've got a grease fire, for example, like maybe the kid is helping prepare some dinner and there's a grease fire on the stove. Like, what do you do in that situation? And so really understanding from the content experts, this is what is the reality and making sure that our experience was as accurate as possible to that so that the educational value would be strong was very important. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And then I also spent a lot of time, you know, driving around to the different fire departments within Ontario and trying to sell this product. And it was quite interesting to also be faced with the challenge of, you know, speaking with older generations. And, you know, I'm a kid just out of university at this point, and I'm coming to them saying, you know, like, this is the new way of educating kids. And this is what you need to be investing in. And this is very important. And it was a very valuable lesson for me that messaging was tough. It was a hard sell. And so really taking that feedback and going back to the drawing board, and it's like, how do I send this message in a better way that's, you know, going to be received by the people that I'm speaking with, the decision makers, the leadership at these departments? And so I leaned on data. I was going in and let's, you know, do a survey. Let's try and gather some data before and after playing the game. You know, did you learn anything? Did you retain anything? And we were able to show that the game was very effective in actually transferring the learning and the skills that we were intending with the experience. So taking that information was, I think, the game changer. And so that was a very valuable learning that I've taken throughout my career is data is quite important and can be very valuable in changing the narrative.
Yeah, and it's a game design for kids as the end user and player. The stakeholder remain parents or, you know, any institutions that would distribute the product, I guess, kids. And those are the people you need also to convince, which is always the challenge. I worked on an educational game and I face also a challenge. And then there's a reality where you are doing almost like, as you described, like door-to-door sales, you know, where you have to go. And thankfully, less in the type of distribution we have with our games, we have to do that. But it's a very tedious, hard part of the job when you do have to sell products like this.
Totally agree. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely a challenge. And I think was the downfall of the operations. It was a very difficult sales cycle for sure.
Mm. And so as you are not doing this role anymore on your startup post university, what happened a few years later? How do you transition maybe to some of the roles either at Gameloft or maybe there was a few stops before that led you later to UKN? What was the journey?
Yeah. So I think when the team decided that we didn't want to continue with the startup anymore and we were seeking different things, I started speaking with some recruiters and sort of sharing information about what I had been doing for the last 2 years. And I was told, you know, it might be product management that's a good fit for you. You know, it sounds like that's what type of things that you've been doing already. And so maybe you might consider those roles. And when I started looking into it more, I felt like, yes, this is definitely where I feel I can fit and have value and impact. And so I began looking for entry-level roles at that point. You know, I had a little bit of experience under my belt, but as you mentioned, you know, I didn't have that experience working at a company yet. And so it's a totally different thing having your own startup when you don't have that experience. Mm-hmm. And so coming into it, I knew I still had a lot to learn. And, you know, that was the types of roles that I was looking for. I actually applied for a marketing role at Behavior. I was not a fit for that. I did not have any experience in marketing, mm-hmm. at least at the capacity that role was covering. But they did see also the product acumen that I think I kind of draw to naturally. And so we started having conversations about a product role and yeah, eventually joined them. They were very early on in their mobile publishing division. And so I was one of the first early hires within the projects were already underway, but they didn't have any product teams formally. And so it was a really great opportunity to get in at the ground floor. But it was also interesting because I came from a startup environment and then I was coming into a team that felt very much like a startup environment again, mm-hmm. you know, really trying to come up with new processes and ways of doing things. You know, there's a lot of experience and talent on the team, but everything was brand new.
Mm-hmm. And a question I want to ask before we get into the detail of your evolution from Behavior to other roles. Another founder asked me recently, female founder, she said, like, I failed the startup, like our startup doesn't make it. Am I seen like a failure and then I'm not employable? And I was surprised by the question. It's like, I see so many valuable skills that you've developed as a founder, but that's my perception, right? And I wonder, did you experience that as you closed your startup? Did that play against you or in the end you had good conversation because it was appreciated that you built, you tried, you learned things, you didn't succeed, but you know, you acquired those skills. What was the experience in that job search for you?
Yeah, I think you have to believe it for yourself, right? Like you have to believe that you've built up value in what you've been doing. So even though maybe the outcome was not what you expected when you set out, the reality is a lot of startups fail. Mm-hmm. A lot of successful startup founders have failed multiple times before they found their winning. And so I think you have to really be careful not to discount yourself. Certainly, you know, in some of the conversations that I had, communicating the value of all of the experience that I gained over that time was difficult. But in a lot of the cases, it was actually quite positive. I was met with a reception and understanding of those skills that I brought. And I think just being honest, like here are the areas I still have limitations in, but here are the skills that I have built. I think it can help you build your own confidence in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. It's very useful tips. I think here, putting myself in the shoes of more recruiter, it's true that how you build the narrative of what you've learned, what you've acquired, also being honest about your skills gap shows that there's a level of professionalism and that you know yourself, which I find a big plus. That level of self-awareness from candidates, applicants, where they haven't figured everything, far from it. But the attitude to it is like, I have learned things, I'm confident in some of my skills, and I'm willing to learn more. That's for me an attitude I appreciate more. That's sometimes feeling like, okay, we did everything right, but that was not the right circumstances. This is like, okay, or very self-diminishing, which it's hard to then have a sense of what can you do really that I can feel sense that you know that you can do, and not the that little voice of lack of self-confidence that sometimes we have. It's a tip as well for the ones finding themselves in that situation, that preparing mentally to own that conversation can change quite a lot the outcome of a conversation.
Definitely agree.
Yeah. And so as you get into behavior, how did your path grow into transition of also, I'm not sure if it's exactly roles, but led you to Gameloft as well in Toronto, and you moved cities, so Montreal, Toronto. How did that transition happen? And your time at Gameloft as well, the role you played on that big game, Disney Magic Kingdoms.
Yeah, so I was really sad to leave Montreal. It's a beautiful city. I really enjoyed my time there. I was there for just a year. And I would have stayed at Behavior longer, but I had family sort of issues that brought me back closer to Toronto. So it was important to move, but yeah, it was very hard, very difficult decision. I loved the team there as well. I think we had a great collaboration going and a lot of camaraderie that we were all really happy to be a part of. And so it was a very difficult decision to move, but I think it was also, you know, really great timing in terms of how it worked out. When I started at Gameloft, I was doing product marketing. So it was a little bit different from product management, which was what I was focused on at Behavior. I was able to transfer some skills, but I also had to learn a lot of new things. And so I think I naturally gravitate towards new challenges and finding new opportunities. And so I really embraced that there was a lot to learn at Gameloft. And I was really fortunate to work on Disney Magic Kingdoms. It turned out to be a really successful game. And I know the team before I joined had spent years iterating on that product and getting it to perfection. And it really was a fantastic game and still is today. And so, yeah, it was a really great opportunity for me to collaborate with Disney and see, you know, how can we build this game into something bigger than, you know, just a game. And so building that community up, working with the community managers, the artists, working with the product team, understanding our users, understanding what they liked and what they didn't like, and really diving into that was a great experience.
And for the transition, you mentioned like you transitioned from product management to product marketing, which indeed is not all of this product in common. It's quite not the same type of skills, but also focus. Who gave you the opportunity to jump in a role where you didn't have full experience? How did that conversation go? I'm quite curious actually about the transition. I don't hear a lot of those opportunities where usually it's like we want experts or we want people very senior in that. And who gave a shot, you know, on letting you try on this new position at Gameloft?
So I guess it was the hiring team as a whole, I would say. So I applied for this role, obviously, and I was honest about here's my background, it's product, here's my startup background experience. But I guess they believed in me and they thought that I could do it. I'm assuming that's what it is. So I remember interviewing with Julie, actually, and, you know, hearing a little bit about the game. And I think at the time they weren't talking about it too publicly. So I don't even think I knew exactly what the game was heading into that interview. But I really liked the team that I met with. I really liked Julie. I think, you know, and we might talk about it a little bit today, but like representation in games is really important. And so, you know, looking at Julie, who's the studio head at Gameloft, it really made me motivated to get this job. Like, I need to work here. I need to have this experience.
That's great to hear. Yeah, I wanted to highlight that because although it may sound trivial how it went for you, I'm just looking at it, you know, from the facts. You were maybe not the best candidate on paper based on experience, right? However, you got the job, and that's more of a story to also see is someone also believed in your potential. And that's also the barrier that sometimes some of us have in the industry when you don't have yet the full experience, et cetera, that you talked about. But you have to start somewhere and have someone giving you the opportunity to prove, which you did here. So it's very inspiring to see that, you know, you can make yourself in new roles or transitional roles, although you don't need to have a full experience before you get there. And especially in another company, because usually those transition would happen internally when you already have a trust of your organization. And okay, we invest in you to get there in the new role, but here it was from a company to another. So, and before we get into your work at UCAN, could you share in a few words, what product marketing is or that you were doing at Gameloft Disney Magic Kingdoms? Because again, I think it's a function that is not always understood. I hear several different definitions of it sometimes. And maybe I want to understand more on the context of at that time, what were you responsible for? What type of work were you doing as product marketing?
So in my experience, it was very much the intersection of where the product, so the game, meets marketing. It's an understanding of the audience that the product is serving, an understanding of how to speak to that audience through the marketing, and also how to just build a community with that audience. So I spent a lot of time, you know, understanding what features are coming from a product perspective. What are we doing from a live ops perspective? How is the community responding to these things? And so it was really just coordinating all of those pieces and then also communicating with the licensor and the IP holder. So what's the visual representation of the game? How are we going to visually market this product and what matters to this audience? So yeah, it's very much just that intersection of all of these moving pieces. And I would say a lot of my role was a collaboration sort of communication. I spent a lot of time just making sure that all of those moving pieces were happening and everyone was on the same page. So a lot of communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, working with multiple stakeholders on the game side, like the developer team, but also you mentioned the audience and I guess like the pure marketing team, like probably PR, communication, even UA probably. So that's quite interesting as what you hear. Yeah, communication and being great collaborator in the process, which is a definition I've heard also from other PMM roles. So now let's get into Huken. If you give more context about how you transitioned to Huken and what is the company focus, where it's at, and we'll get into the question then, what led you to the role you have today? But maybe more, let's start with the transition first.
Yeah, so about 6 years ago, I had been working on Disney Magic Kingdoms for just over 2 years. And so it was an interesting time for me where I felt like I had gone through a lot of the challenges. There was certainly a lot of learnings that I did at the beginning of that project and throughout, but I gained a lot of experience and I just ultimately felt like I wasn't being challenged with new things. And I think, again, for me, I'm always seeking out what's that next challenge, what's that new thing, trying to learn new things and always having something to strive for is really important. So yeah, I was looking around at different opportunities and in particular, you know, something that would be a good fit in alignment with what I wanted for my career and where I, you know, saw myself going. And so, you know, I began speaking with some folks at Huken and it was quite interesting and appealing what they were working on at the time. It was very experimental. It was something that I really personally liked and took an interest to. And I think there was just a lot of vision and energy coming from the company that I really gravitated towards. And doing some reflection on just the different experiences that I've had, you know, at Gameloft, it was a very large organization. You've got people spread across the world. So you're dealing with different time zones. You're dealing with different cultural and language barriers. You're dealing with all kinds of things. That role is a lot more of coordinating things, but the hands-on work was more limited. And a smaller company like Huken, you have more ability to do more things. You can try out different tasks. You can understand what this other person does more easily because they sit beside you. So it was just sort of something that, again, aligned with where I wanted to go in my career. And I think offered things that I was looking for.
Mm. And it's funny, I see, you know, the cycle where you started with a very startup-y environment and then you learn, but you always have a bit that entrepreneurial step in the roles you took because there was some kind of a level up to acquire quickly in the new roles, maybe new environment. But at the heart of it, you know, like enjoying the startup environment where you can be very hands-on, like you say, being presented a variety of challenges and learning quickly. In startup, by definition, you have more work than you can do with a number of people. That's the reality, which is good for some people who are driven like this, and it can be overwhelming for others. So I can see the, you know, the pattern going back to some origins. And so how did you start there and how did you grow? Because I noted down actually where over 5 years, you have five roles, at least according to LinkedIn, starting with product management, then senior role, then leadership, then director role, and maybe like more head of studio and then co-CEO. How did that journey happen? Is it like, this is like where I see is like, wow, express promotion. And if you could give us some context until today.
Yeah, it was a very busy 5 years. I think I'm very thankful, you know, it was exactly what I was looking for. You can just that ability to gain exposure to a broader variety of roles and tasks to really get that hands-on experience, understand different things that I didn't know before and get that exposure. So I was really fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. And then to also have some really great mentorship as well throughout the time. And so I feel like sort of what you're saying as well, just throughout my career, I'm just like a sponge gathering information and collecting different experiences and sort of taking those all into the next thing. And so it's very much just pulling on all of that information and learnings. And I think that's what I use and lead on to help accelerate things. And so, you know, I started working on this experimental project. Unfortunately, that project never released, but it was something that there was a lot of energy about, you know, internally. And so I think through that, I was able to show some of the entrepreneurial side. I was able to show, you know, some of the creative ideas that I had for how we could maybe pivot it, what we could do with it. And then had a little bit of time working on our other titles that we had. So Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Jeopardy World Tour. So both mobile free-to-play games. I spent time on both, just sort of understanding how they work, worked really closely with the Millionaire team. And yeah, I think just throughout all of that experience, just remaining curious about new things, seeing where I can add value. And yeah, when there was an open call for ideas at the organization, and I thought, you know, this is my opportunity to really show what I can bring to the table and, you know, the thought process that I have and the perspective that I can bring. And yeah, I was really thankful that I was heard and, you know, there was a safe space to do that at UFIN. I think that's a really great thing about the company is that ideas can be shared by literally anyone at any time. And there's always reception for that. So I was really happy to see my idea really being received well and appreciated. And so that was sort of the turning point, I would say, the growth point where from there, I became very involved in that new project and saw that through the concept phase, the ideation, all of the early pre-production work, right through to live operations and really working on that, refining the game further, having a lot of conviction, I think, in who the audience was going to be for this game and how it needed to be presented and just drawing on all of the product and product marketing experience that I collected over the years to bring that concept to life with the team. And again, like that project was huge. The team is really talented and it took every single person on that team to bring it together. But just sort of being there to help guide that and steer it in the right direction, I think was something that sort of proved to the organization that, you know, I can operate at that level.
So if I see some patterns a bit more, and also for the listener who are wondering how do they grow, you know, internally in career, and if this is maybe more to the point of your entrepreneurial approach, you took some initiatives, also some opportunities or things to create, and you just did it, and that the promotion conversation went very organically. How, again, because, you know, I know I've been seeing structure where just updating your title takes forever, and sometimes you do more senior role that you should be doing. You don't have a title updated, and that's fine. So I just wonder how the process went, especially over those 5 years, that, okay, Veronica, we want you to take care of that, be in charge of this, to, I think, a big role, co-CEO. So first of all, it's a new role I see emerging more. That CEO admits, okay, I need help. I need somebody. I said maybe an intentional successor plan. So could you give us a bit more also visibility on how that process of promotion happened for you to really a big responsibility role for someone who joined 5 years ago?
Yeah, so I would agree. It happened very naturally. I think through that game pitch and sort of working with the team on that, it was a very fundamental part of that promotion path for myself. And yeah, I began having conversations. You know, we've got a few products that are going now and we've got no director of product. There's no one that's sort of overseeing how we're doing things. Everyone's doing different things on each project. And, you know, we can probably optimize that better and we can probably, you know, be more intentional about it. And so really carving a path for myself, I think was also important in sort of advocating for myself. And, you know, it started with advocating for, okay, there's this frustration because, you know, we're not sharing information or we're doing different processes. And so that develops into, okay, well, how could it be better? And thinking about that. So instead of just bringing, I guess, problems to my direct manager, it's sort of bringing ideas. So it's the problem and the idea, right? It's like, how can we solve this? Was probably part of that unlock and in how it grew so organically is just having those open conversations regularly. It wasn't a single conversation. It was over a period of time having many of these types of conversations where you start to build that trust and you start to build that presence that you can add value in these areas. And so, yeah, very naturally, very organically, but also very intentionally as well.
Mm-hmm. And the last role that you have today, which can cover quite a lot, since how long have you been co-CEO? How did that happen? And what are you sharing your responsibility with the CEOs if you have distinct responsibilities?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate to have a really great co-CEO in Chris Yee. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Chris co-founded the company with Mark many years ago. And so he's got a ton of experience and knowledge that I see as great value. And so we've built a really great working relationship together over the years. I really have a lot of respect for the experience that he brings to the table. And I think for us, you know, successful partnership is built on that trust, the communication, but also a division of roles. Like, we recognize that we have different strengths in different areas. And so leaning on each other in those areas is very important to ensure that we're delivering the best we can for the organization and for the team. So this true like diversity of thought and approach really helps us to address challenges from different angles and ensure that we have a really well-rounded decision-making process. So the co-dynamic has been very beneficial, I think, for both of us in what we've been able to do. We've got a greater depth of focus in some areas of the business where we don't overlap, and that's healthy, I think. And then for myself, I'm still very much operating in a more executional role, sort of more of a head of studio role, working really closely with our production teams on the delivery of new games and updates, which is something that I'm naturally just very passionate about. And I like to sort of be involved with the team on. So I think we found a really good balance that works for us. It's just 1 year into the co-CEO dynamic. And so it's something that we're both sort of getting used to and improving on and iterating on over time. And I think it's just very fitting for Yuken. You know, we've got a very iterative team and process, and that's just how we do things at Yuken. And so for sure, we're always looking at our code dynamic and trying to understand how we can improve it and what could be better and what's working and what's not. And so, yeah, I think it's going well so far. And, you know, I'm really excited to continue learning from Chris as well.
Mm. And I think it's a great dynamic to see. It's there so much on the shoulder of a CEO. It also feels like a very lonely role from all my conversation. And I see more of this model. I think of Isabel, who's the co-CEO at Clan Games with Mundi. Distinct responsibility shared. And it's like more healthy where you also keep accountability with each other, you know, where you trust each other. So you are working as sort of a magical pairs, very distinct complementary skills. So it's great to see more of those models and also opportunities maybe for women to step up to roles without having to replace the CEO. But for me, it's a natural path I see to prepare for a succession plan, if even that has to go there. But it's always good to have someone who's ready to lead the company if that's not the CEO. It's always thinking, you know, who's ready and prepared for promotion. So I'm super happy for you that you get to the role and the responsibility. And my last question is more what comes with as a challenge as well with taking that responsibility, because being responsible indeed for a team, a game, a company, it's quite on many levels, different levels, right? You have finances, you have external communication, internal, so many areas. So could you share more where you're at? What are the challenges?
Yeah, I think it's very accurate to say that it's a totally different thing. It really is a different level of responsibility. And I think the first maybe 6 months or 8 months was feeling the true weight of what that feels like. And again, I'm really thankful that Chris is very available. And so I can always lean on him when I'm feeling I'm in the unknown and need some help. So that's really been working well for me, but certainly totally agree. Like, the level of responsibility is something that, you know, I was, I think, mentally aware of, but just didn't necessarily understand until you really feel it. And so just being really thoughtful about, you know, what does the team need and how can I support them? But then also, what does the business need and how do I make the best decisions there? And so, you know, you start to have a lot more reflections of, you know, earlier on in your career when certain decisions were made and you really didn't understand them, you start to understand things a little bit better. And it's sort of an interesting reflection that I've been doing. Also sort of trying to take that experience that I had and say, okay, I understand how this information is going to land with the team more. You know, this is how maybe I would have preferred it to be done back when I was, you know, earlier in my career. So just trying to always improve on things and learn from that experience, but then learn from the decisions that I'm making now. I think the biggest challenge for me has been, you know, I come from this product background where data is very readily available. You make a decision, you're going to run an A/B test, you run the test, and you immediately can start tracking the data of how that test is performing. So you have a pretty instantaneous view of, was this the right call or not? And I think in my new role, what I'm struggling with the most is letting go of that expectation that there's information readily available and being more comfortable with decision making that you're not going to see the outcome for 6 months or a year or 2 years, and really trying to sit with that has been tough. And so calibrating your decision-making is really difficult in that environment where the feedback is not readily available. And being mentally prepared for that, I think, was something that I just didn't really recognize until, again, I was in the role. And so that's been a big adjustment for me, is how do I make sure that I'm still making the right decisions, but calibrating myself on some other scale and some other indicators.
It's a very good point indeed, the level of uncertainty and not validation, immediate validation of your decision, because at that level, it's a lot of long-term impact. And it will take time to understand the impact of your decision because of the complexity level of an organization. All right. Thanks a lot, Veronica, for joining. Good luck with the role and all the challenges. And thanks for joining today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sophie.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Rise and Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders, because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on riseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time.